I am not Joe Scarborough.
And I'm not Mika Brzezinski.
She's smarter than you are.
And he's better looking than you.
Ouch.
Hey, but we do like their format of current topics, friendly conversation, smart guests, and a sprinkling of witty humor.
Today's primary topic is truth in journalism. Both facts and journalism as a profession have taken a serious hit over the past 4 or 5 years, and it seems to be getting worse on several levels, which is fueling the tribal divide in America today.
Welcome to the second episode of A Broad Range of Intelligent People.
A primary reason we started this show is to try to restore facts into the discussion and hopefully establish a more honest and critical review of news sources.
Some of you may be feeling like Clara Peller in the mid-80s when trying to find verifiable information.
Where's the beef?
We'll discuss how to judge accuracy in news.
Today we have the amazing Shep Bennett back with us. Hi, Shep.
Hey guys, what's going on?
And we have a special guest, former executive editor of The Village Voice, Richard Goldstein, who will be joining us for a two-part interview.
Okay, so we're all journalists by training and trade. And so today we're going to take a look at facts versus fake news and how the average consumer of news can ever hope to make heads or tails of the information they're receiving today.
Let's get it started off with, I read an article in the Washington Post back in May that talked about how three major news organizations all got a particular set of facts wrong about Rudy Giuliani. And what I found most interesting is that A, it was from the Washington Post, but it was talking about three specific news outlets, the New York Times, NBC News, and the Washington Post itself. And so, you know, the fact that they got wrong was whether or not, you know, Giuliani had been briefed by the FBI. And it kind of like snowballed and CNN had kind of got in there as well. But one of the things that I use myself as an indicator of whether or not a news outlet has some credibility and validity is when they do get it wrong, they will step forward and admit it. And so, you know, this was an article from the Washington Post that talked about how the Washington Post itself got things wrong. And so when there's a self editing and a self-correction mechanism, I always see that as a genuine, you know, indicator of credibility. Because, you know, news organizations are, you know, we've got humans in them. And anytime there's humans, there's going to be mistakes. At the end of the day, for me, it's a matter of whether or not the outlet really wants to get it right or not.
Well, in our lifetimes, we all remember times when the old gray lady and the major news networks and other sources corrected themselves when they reported something that was blatantly false, or where they got a couple of things wrong, you know, and those couple of things to change the color, so to speak, of the story. And that was something that was embarrassing, but an assumed responsibility by said organization. Now it seems to be more of like a he said, she said, or nanny nanny boo boo, or prove it. And there are networks that are operating from an entirely different set of facts than others are.
There's a lot of internal squabbling, that's for sure.
Yeah. I also remember seeing a meme a few years back, and I think it was CNN, Barack Obama had Pepsi at lunch. And then Fox News said, Brock prefers Pepsi than over Coca-Cola because it's a far more liberal product. And there was another network that said something else about, you know, Obama excoriating people who work for one or the other. And then it had BBC News. Today in Afghanistan, 4 children were killed as a bomb went off. Also in Italy, you know, and so the point was BBC News decided to report the news as opposed to everybody else trying to politicize a can of Pepsi. When I hear an event or see an event, then I immediately look for who's going to politicize it first, the network, or if they're going to find a politician to do so. And it's what the site we've been trained to, we as consumers of news have been trained to look toward, as opposed to looking at what a story may actually mean.
So something that should be concerning to all of us is how the conservatives and how organizations like Fox News, led by Rupert Murdoch and the late Roger Ailes, have attacked credibility in journalism for decades, such that 50 years ago, 70% of Americans found their media credible. These days, 60% of Americans find the media not credible. And that's a problem. And, you know, it's an issue with, you know, where we're at in this country. And there are tribal divides. And the whole point is for many information sources out there, the intent is to misrepresent, is to not tell the truth or the facts. And indeed, I would argue, engage in fraud with information.
Is this how we were trained when we were in journalism school?
I actually, one of my classes back in the day was taught by Professor Carl Stern, who was, you know, an old
NBC
correspondent and a pretty good one. And I remember one of the things that he said is that, you know, I think, I'm not saying that he had gone over to the dark side by any stretch of the imagination, because I think he did still believe in integrity. But he said that this is a circus, you know, and at the end of the day, the media industry is driven by ratings. And so, you know, you've got to try to get people's attention. Now, I still think it is possible to, you know, ride the balance of presenting real facts in an interesting way. And I think the best of us as journalists are able to tell stories in a way that people will want to tune into. And you can highlight certain things. You've got to know who your audience is, but it doesn't mean that you have to lie. And I'm seeing, you know, all politicians to some degree or another don't always tell the truth, or they spin things in certain ways, for sure. But it's our job as journalists professionally to scratch it below the surface of that and try to find out, you know, what's really being said. And I do think that there are certain news outlets out there that are taking the fiction of what politicians are saying, and they are promoting it actively and enthusiastically, and they know what they're saying is wrong. And, you know, that should have consequences. And it right now, it doesn't. It right now, the consequence is an increase in viewership. And so they're actually making money off of it in a really terrible way. And I think a large portion of America is being deceived, and they're happy about it. You know, they're just like, let's go. You know, take down America. And they see it as being patriotic, but that's, you know, that's a whole nother thing. Speaking of, the Supreme Court has been up to a lot of things. So specifically, I saw a Reuters story this week saying that the Supreme Court has rebuffed an appeal by a florist who, you know, refused to work for a gay couple.
A same-sex couple, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that there's a narrative out there right now that, sure, the Supreme Court is 6-3 conservative to the right, but they're trying to, you know, come at things, you know, somewhat moderately. In fact, the Washington Post specifically also had a story this week that said Barrett moves Supreme Court to the right, but cautiously. And basically what it said is that they are, you know, they're definitely going to the right, but they're not, you know, they're not doing it without breaks. And I am concerned that the moderation that they're using is creating a veneer of credibility, and that veneer is kind of lulling the left into thinking, oh, everything is not as bad as it appears. And I think it kind of is, because if you look, you know, a little bit further down into the story at the Washington Post, it specifically says how frequently each justice was in the majority. And the conservative bloc, you know, it goes from Kavanaugh to Thomas, and they are always, or they go from 78% to 97% in the majority opinion. And the liberal bloc is 69 to 77 from Sotomayor to Breyer. And that, you know, I think Breyer, Kagan, and Sotomayor really have very little influence right now in the majority of the final decisions of what's happening in the Supreme Court. And so we are seeing a shift to the right. And however moderated it is, it still really, really scares me.
Well, let me add a couple of things to this. For this particular case, in any case, you need at least four justices to vote in favor of granting a petition for review by the court to hear a pending case. In this particular case, by a tally published by the court, Alito, Gorsuch, and Clarence Thomas were in favor of hearing this particular case. You know, the three sore thumbs for the conservatives, so to speak. I mean, they are the foundation of the conservative end of the court, and they voted to go for it, unusually for this particular court. They didn't want to wade into the waters talking about non-discrimination protections for LGBTQ people in this particular instance as it butts up against the First Amendment. In this term of the court, a large majority of the case, 39 of 65 of the cases were decided by a 9-0 or 8-1 vote, including four wins for the government over immigration, defeats for Ford Motor Company seeking to limit lawsuits, a win in for California motorists who objected to the police, a police officer following them into their garage. I'm getting this from MSN. And we talk, of course, one of the big cases this week was the NCAA and whether or not athletes can be paid for their appearances, seeking a shield for antitrust claims brought by college athletes, and that lost 9-0. That was unanimous. In any case, this is an analysis from MSNBC about how the court appears under Roberts. And Roberts has been willing to hand down strongly conservative rulings that divide the court as relates to political power. He had a lot to say about the voting rights issue in the voting rights issue in Georgia. You know, the House Democrats, specifically Congressional Black Caucus, they were pushing for ratifying or approving the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. And this was crushed by the Supreme Court's decision to side with Arizona. And so in the wake of that, House Democrats, according to The Hill, are introducing a bill restoring voting provisions after that particular ruling. Congressman Ruben Gallego of Arizona and Mondaire Jones of New York, they introduced a bill restoring the provision of the Voting Rights Act after the Supreme Court upheld two restrictions in Arizona. And this bill, dubbed the Inclusive Elections Act of 2021, aims to restore Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. It was Roberts who said that Section 2 indeed has protections for voters and that it was not as limiting as Democrats have indicated that it actually is. So I don't know. There's kind of a flip of a coin with this court, and I certainly understand and I think I would agree with your perspective about it seeming to slowly drift to the right in the eyes of Americans, in the eyes of voters who have nothing to do with who gets elected to the court. But in any case, or placed on the court. But Robert seems to be a flip of a coin. He seems to go either way. People were very upset with him. A lot of conservative people were very upset with him for sitting out the second impeachment. But he pointed out that constitutionally, that's not his jam. He's not supposed to be involved in that.
Well, I'm just curious. I just want to say that the ruling in the Arizona case is pretty dreadful, preventing the collection of absentee ballots from communities that are remote and distant from polling places. Is going to have a disparate impact on minority communities. And in Arizona, it's going to have a disparate impact on Native American populations. and suggesting that somebody who casts a ballot in the wrong precinct, first of all, shame on the precinct officers, the precinct captains, for allowing that to happen, because you should be able to check somebody in when they, you know, against their registration when they come in to vote. So I don't know how it's possible to actually cast a vote in the wrong precinct, but, you know, not counting that vote is also further disenfranchising people. And, you know, these are really important things. As far as the ruling in the Florist case, you know, it's interesting because if you ask conservatives, you know, would it be wrong to deny a table at a restaurant to Senator Ted Cruz if the owner of the restaurant was liberal or the patrons in the restaurant didn't like Ted Cruz? Would they defend the restaurant owner for not serving Ted Cruz and asking him to leave? They would attack the restaurant owner. And yet they want florists to be able to deny, or bakers to deny, same-sex couples flowers or wedding cakes. We're in an interesting time in America, and unfortunately I see where the Supreme Court is going right now, favoring the bigotry of the right and giving permission to disenfranchise voters, disenfranchise minority voters, and to excuse bigotry. That's really what the rulings were this week.
My theory is that Roberts has a strategy of trying to maintain the appearance of credibility, of being objective, so that he can gut the Voting Rights Act. And, you know, the last decision, you know, he maybe moderated it a bit, but it's still it's making it nearly impossible to take certain cases moving forward. And, you know, there's a CNN report this week that 17 states have now enacted close to 30 new laws, making it harder to vote. And it's, you know, it's going to be harder now for the Justice Department and other aspects of government to use the Voting Rights Act to, you know, fight these laws. And these laws are largely, you know, in the South, they're largely in Republican strongholds like Texas, like Florida. And, you know, Republicans currently control both chambers of 30 state legislatures right now, which is a thing, because if they want to completely, you know, steamroll democracy, that can happen. And there's nothing really to effectively stop it.
These restrictions on voting that many Republicans are passing throughout states right now in the country where they control the legislatures and they have a governor to sign these bills into law, you know, preventing so-called ballot harvesting, preventing any more than three unrelated people in a car at the same time on a Sunday going to vote. You know, they are pretending that it's only liberal Black people or college students who are going to engage in this kind of behavior. But yet you've had very far to the right evangelical churches across the country for quite some time, putting people in large vans or small buses and getting them to the polls on Sunday, collecting ballots after they encourage their parishioners how to vote. So these laws could also have a disparate impact on white evangelical Republican voters. And that's kind of an interesting other side of the coin here. And I'm wondering if the laws in these very Republican states will be enforced against white evangelical voters who may try these tactics as well, or if we're just going to focus on enforcing them in Black communities and against Black churches and Black church parishioners and Native American voters in Arizona, for example. So something to be looked at as this develops and as it plays out.
And the New York Times also did an article that said that, you know, in a recent survey, one in three elections officials are saying that they don't feel safe in their jobs. A lot of them are stopping early and, you know, opting out because they are scared for their lives. They're scared for their families' lives. And that shouldn't happen. You know, that's not democracy. That's not, you know, simply telling the truth shouldn't put your life in danger.
Is this a good time to hear from Richard Goldstein?
I think it probably is.
We are here today with progressive icon and national treasure, Richard Goldstein. Among Richard's many accomplishments, he was the executive editor of The Village Voice until 2004. His writings have appeared in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, New York Magazine, Harper's, Art Forum, The Guardian, The Advocate, Esquire, Vogue, The Huffington Post, Salon, and Atlantic.com. He has also made appearances on CNN's Crossfire, MSNBC, Fox News' Hannity and The O'Reilly Factor, PBS, ABC's Nightline, New York One, and NPR. He has taught at Columbia, the City College of New York, the School of Visual Arts, City University of New York, and currently at the Clive David Institute for Recorded Music, which is part of Tisch at NYU. Welcome to the show, Richard. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We're talking about the state of truth in journalism today. How do you think truth is doing in today's media environment?
Well, you know, the first thing that comes to my mind is a quote from George Orwell. I don't always agree with him, but I do about this. And he said, "We all know that newspapers don't lie, but we also know that they don't tell the truth." So truth has never been a hallmark of journalism. There has always been a slant. There has always been a bias, depending on the ideology and readership of the publication. And the same is true of television. Even though the three networks that began in television were supposed to be objective and neutral, they never were. So, and now with cable television, the partisanship is more obvious. And the internet totally blasts the notion that there are professionals in journalism and replaces them with amateurs. This replacement of professionals with amateurs is something that has been going on for a century as technology has advanced. For example, letters to the editor are something that begin in the early 20th century as amateur readers begin to weigh in newspapers. And this whole process, criticism, film criticism, rock criticism, all of that stuff is part of a process in which amateurs replace professionals. So those two things that are going on today have existed for a long, long time in journalism. It's just that they're more apparent and more extreme now.
Is one side more guilty than the other? Is it only the Republicans that are lying? Or are there mistakes being made on the Democrat and liberal side as well?
It isn't one side. It's both sides, but it's everywhere. It's not just sides. It's every publication. The way to come upon something that is closest to the truth is to experience many, many different points of view, because then you can begin to piece together something that seems true to you. But if you're looking for the actual truth from one source, you're unlikely to find it. What the right wing does today is very extreme, but it's not more extreme than things were in the 60s. These kinds of fabrications have existed for a long time. But with the publications on the right today, it's tied to an insurrectionary fervor that itself is dangerous. But the actual phenomenon of being untruthful is something that is longstanding in journalism. And it is, in a way, supposed to be there. That is to say, it has never been a standard in American journalism that said that you had to be truthful as a standard for being qualified to be a journalist. No one has ever said journalists have to be truthful. It's just not a criterion. So the difference is now there's this violent insurrection. And that's really, that's distinct and different. There was an insurrection on the left in the 60s, and there also was a lot of biased reporting on the left. So there's a precedent for this. But today we have the threat is from the right. There's a dialectic, by which I mean there's a relationship of opposites. So if the right wing is extreme toward, toward fabrication, the left wing will be obsessed with accuracy. If the left wing is extreme toward fabrication, the right will be oriented toward accuracy. These things are in relationship. So right now, the left is more accurate than the right. But if you go back 50 years, the right was more accurate than the left. So you have to, you just have to come prepared as a consumer of information to ask yourself right away, what is the ideological bias of the thing I am reading or watching? And how do I factor that into whatever they're saying?
As a consumer of media, how does one find the truth?
How does one by reading a lot, by watching a lot, by getting a wide variety and diversity of opinions and explanations for why things are as they are. Wide variety of descriptions of reality, none of which in and of itself will be totally truthful. But put together, you begin to develop a sense for yourself of what's true and what isn't.
So do you think we're any worse off today than we've been in the past in terms of inaccuracies or straight-up fallacies in American journalism?
Well, no. I mean, you know, journalists were reporting in the 19th century that Andrew Jackson had an illegitimate black child. This rumor spread through the country on the wings of media of the time. And it was so horrible that his wife nearly had a nervous breakdown from it. I mean, there's all this stuff that, you know, has gone on for centuries, amplified by the media of its time. Now, media are so pervasive and so various and so omnipresent that it probably is more dangerous just because of the frequency with which we're accosted by media. So one solution would be less media, you know, make it more like the 19th century. But no, we can't do that because technology advances. So the danger is partly caused by the propinquity of media.
On a scale of 1 to 5, 1 being all lies and 5 being nothing but the truth, give a number for each of the following outlets.
Okay, I don't know if I can do this numerically, but I'll try.
CNN.
Oh, my God. I can't. It depends on the story. You know, some stories, they're totally accurate. Some stories, they're not. Some stories, a bias insinuates itself. Sometimes it doesn't. So it's the same with Fox. Once in a while, Fox is telling you something that you need to know.
If you had to do an overall on the aggregate rating.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to do it numerically. I would say that as a whole, CNN has a greater reliance on accuracy than Fox. Its viewers demand that. Fox viewers demand certain kinds of distortions. That's what they get. CNN viewers, they'll demand a lot of distortion in certain subjects, but not in others. So that's what CNN provides. A newspaper or a TV network gives the viewer, gives the consumer what the consumer wants. So you have to look at the class and orientation of the consumer, and then you'll be able to detect the biases in the media.
Fox.
Fox has consumers who are embittered, feel treated with contempt, are very anxious about race and gender, and are generally less well-educated than the viewers of MSNBC. Hence, the biases on Fox play to that profile. On MSNBC, where people are more familiar with the faculty lounge than they are with the bar, that you're likely to get other biases on MSNBC to suit those viewers.
Washington Post.
Washington Post is one of the sort of mainstream journalism outlets, has its very high standards of accuracy, but you can read things in the Washington Post that, while they are actually accurate, are actually false. It happens. The same with the New York Times. There are many things that are accurate in the New York Times that are actually false.
BuzzFeed.
BuzzFeed, a good investigative outlet of journalism, but, I'm up the wazoo with listicles and all that other stuff, and I occasionally think they look in the wrong places, and then they find what they're looking for. The Me Too movement is an example, their coverage of it. If you look for something, you will find it. So that's another form of bias in the media. What you look for determines what you will find. So when you read BuzzFeed, you're getting what they found is what they looked for.
Vanity Fair.
I don't read Vanity Fair. You know, I'm not going to read any publication that's edited by somebody who lunches in the village at fancy restaurants. So I'm not interested in that.
BBC.
BBC, just ask its critics if they're accurate. They would say no. Sometimes they aren't. Usually they're reliable. Again, they have biases. They like the royal family.
USA Today.
USA Today I don't read.
Why don't you read USA Today?
Oh, because it's like drinking a cup of broth. There isn't any meat there.
The Guardian.
The Guardian is quite biased in certain subjects. It's a left-wing newspaper, but it's also accurate. So again, you read it, what you're saying is accurate, but it has a distinct bias toward the left. And you see this all the time in the pages of The Guardian. There are all kinds of assumptions that underlie their journalism. That doesn't mean that it's fake. It's not fake. It's just biased.
NBC.
I'm a CBS person. That I have been ever since Edward R. Murrow, despite the fact that they've had lapses of homophobia, which need to be mentioned. But I generally trust them more than I do other networks. But they have a somewhat more liberal history than the other TV networks.
NBC?
No, CBS. So I would say NBC less so. You have to look at who their ownership is, also what their tradition is. Coming from Murrow and other progressives, CBS tends to have a more liberal a set of interests than the other networks. So that's probably why I watch them. Also, it's for old people. Just look at all the ads for medicines on that show. I mean, you know, that's all you see on CBS. It's all you see is ads for diseases you never even knew you had.
ABC.
Occasionally I like the guys in tight t-shirts. But I'm a big, huge, I have a huge crush on Nora on CBS. So I think she has the greatest color schemes on television.
New York Post.
The New York Post is not a newspaper. It's an entertainment. So having that in mind when I read it, it's a guilty pleasure.
Have we gone wrong? And if so, where?
What, we've gone wrong in many ways, but how do you mean? I mean, I don't know where we might have gone wrong. You cannot stop these forces that you object to. You can't stop this because they're technologically driven. You cannot really control the internet because it's global. It's like whack-a-mole. If you hammer down a mole, another mole will pop up. And people who want that kind of stuff will find it. So it's uncontrollable. But that's the Jeffersonian idea of the media.
So are you saying that this is hopeless? Is it supply and demand and it's human nature and no matter what we do?
No, I'm not saying that it's hopeless. Or that it is human nature, you know, to seek affirmation in the form of information rather than the truth. Do people actually seek to be affirmed rather than being told the truth? I would say so. But it's not hopeless because if it leads to a consumer literacy where consumers are prepared for what they receive and they know why something is the way it is, then it can be tolerated because you have a brain that can filter through all of this. In academic life, this is called reception theory, and it means that the audience receives the information through the filter of its class, its race, its gender, and all kinds of other considerations. So what the viewer or the reader does with this information depends on who they are. So all I'm saying is that you have to know that you're getting something less than truthful, and then you have to try to assemble the truth from bits and pieces that come from different sources. That's consumer literacy, and that's where I think the hope lies.
Is there anything that can be done to hold outlets accountable, particularly some of the more financially profitable propaganda machines?
Well, libel law is an instrument that can be used to hold media accountable. The problem is that libel laws are used by wealthy people to squelch the truth. And they sue people who can't afford to defend themselves. And then they repress the truth that way. But the judicious use of libel law is a tool built into the First Amendment and that consciousness that allows for some kind of restraint of media. In terms of actually punishing media for telling things that aren't truthful, I think that is a dangerous path to go down. eventually will result in media that are confined to a certain point of view. That is, happens to be the point of view of your people.
How can we get out of the scenario we are in where people are watching Fox News because they want the red meat?
Yeah. Well, people watch MSNBC because they want the red meat, too. It's just that one is veal and one is beef. In other words, they're different meats. But it's still about meat. And so you have to look at the whole thing. And then you start repressing Rachel Maddow because she said something that you think is fake. Then you go and repress Hannity. And before long, you're left with, I don't know, some kind of mishmash of banal stuff that no one watches. And you're left with a kind of directed media that no one believes. So I don't think that's a good solution. I think it's dangerous to do that.
Do you think any of the above outlets are more genuinely interested in telling the truth?
I think it's possibly true that for more liberal media, they don't have quite the same self-awareness that they're telling things that aren't true. They think they're telling the truth. My image is that people who work for Fox aren't really convinced that everything they say is true. And people who work for MSNBC think they are always telling the truth. People at the Times are convinced they're always telling the truth. People at the New Yorker think they're telling the truth with a metaphor. But the fact is that, you know, everybody thinks they're basically being truthful.
Even Fox?
Well, I think they think that there's an underlying truthfulness to the falsity. So, you know, they think they're telling a deeper truth. At the Times, they think everything, every word, every punctuation is truthful, when in fact it all expresses a bias.
I've heard stories about Fox being sued for libel, and their actual legal defense is that no reasonable person would actually believe what they're hearing on Fox.
Yeah, but that is a defense against libel. You can actually say that this is something no one would ever believe, and you can be acquitted of charges. I don't think that will hold up in court in this case.
But there are particular shows on Fox where it would appear they're not even trying to appear credible.
Yeah, well, what they say is that when we have our news roundup, we are telling only the truth. When we have our commentary, we are telling opinion. What Hannity does is commentary, and so it's his opinion. It's not meant to be, you know, it's not the gospel. It's not any gospel. It's an opinion. And if you start to prescribe what opinions are allowed on television and what aren't, again, you're headed down a very dangerous path of standardizing information, which I think some progressives would like to see. And a lot of right-wingers would like to see it, too. Truth is something you assemble within yourself according to your own personality and according to your capacity to receive a lot of information from a lot of sources, and then from all of those sources, come up with an idea of what you think is really going on.
Are you saying truth in journalism is a lost cause?
Truth in journalism is an aggregate. In other words, it's the summation of all of your experiences in journalism. Any one outlet in journalism could be accurate and not truthful. And that's what I would say goes on. You read something, you see something, you hear something. It can be accurate, but not truthful.
Thank you, Richard. We'll continue the interview on our next episode, where we talk about the viability of American democracy and right-wing media specifically.
Okay, a pleasure, real pleasure.
And that was Richard Goldstein, who is, he's a personal friend of mine, in full disclosure, and sometimes we have knocked down, drag out fights about some of these topics, because I don't always fully agree with him 100%. But he's been in the game a long time. And, you know, as an executive editor of the Village Voice, he has been around since the beginning of time, and he's a tried and true journalist.
Well, thanks for joining us. Next time on the second part of the Richard Goldstein interview, we'll discuss the direction our country itself is heading.
The class system is so locked in at this point that it produces an overwhelming amount of bitterness on all sides, and the struggle for racial equity and gender equity, which must be fought, also produces a terrible backlash which people don't pay enough attention to.
That's not a heavy topic at all.
Hey, we can balance it with levity and humor.
Yeah, like a tightrope walker without a net in a hurricane.
That's not going to end well, is it?
Eh.
She said, I've had burgers with other ribs. Now I got one that ain't even there. She got no response.